By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Emerging Markets Decoded, the podcast that tackles the latest trends shaping the world of emerging markets. I'm your host for today, Ariane Ortiz-Bolin, from Moody's Global Emerging Markets team, coming to you from New York. Since our last episode, the Russia-Ukraine military conflict has escalated with Russia invading Ukraine, resulting first and foremost in a tragic loss of life and humanitarian catastrophe. But this rapidly evolving situation is also having global repercussions through not only higher oil prices, which will feed through to higher inflation in many countries around the world, but also through increased financial market volatility. We'll explore the ways in which this crisis could change our baseline view on global macroeconomic conditions. Plus, the pandemic isn't over yet, but we've taken stock at several points of how it has impacted all aspects of our lives and of our economies. Last July, after the significant economic growth shock, our colleagues in the Sovereign team did a global exercise to calculate the degree of economic scarring each country would experience. And by economic scarring, we mean the long-lasting economic impact of a shock. 7 months after that exercise, how much have our growth forecasts changed? Do we still expect the same countries to experience deep or some scarring? But first up, I'm joined by my colleague Madhvi Bokil from our credit strategy team in New York to discuss our updated outlook on global macroeconomic conditions amid this escalating crisis in Europe. Madhvi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ariane, for having me.
Madhvi, we know the ongoing conflict and sanctions have been devastating for both the Russian and the Ukrainian economies. But what are the channels of credit impact for the rest of the world?
The economic and credit impact of this conflict really depends on how long this crisis lasts, Ariane. While the situation is quite fluid, it seems like the very significant sanctions on Russia will remain in place. We are potentially looking at a long period of an uncertain economic environment. Now, there are three main channels of impact for the global economy. One is a commodity price channel, the other is the trade channel, and thirdly, the financial markets channel. Now, in case of the commodity price channel, we are seeing a commodity price shock, which is exacerbating already high inflationary pressures, potentially hurting commodity importers and benefiting commodity exporters. Now, high energy costs. As you know, oil prices are quite high, about 100 now. Higher energy costs tend to weigh on household and business budgets by increasing costs of transportation, heating, energy-intensive manufacturing costs, as well as costs of production of a variety of products, including fertilizers and, most importantly, food. So there is downside risk to the global economy in terms of growth and upside risk to already high inflation. And these risks are quite significant. Now, in terms of the trade channel, particularly European economies that depend on gas supplies from Russia are at risk of a material shock to the economic growth. Gas supplies have not come under sanctions yet and not been cut, but Europe's weight in global GDP means that a significant negative shock there would have an impact on global growth. Now, in case of the financial channel, we are looking at widespread risk aversion, tighter financing conditions for high yield issuers, and for some emerging market countries, some of which are already experiencing a constrained access to financing. In addition, the dollar has strengthened because of the risk aversion. The fallout on Russian banks following the announcement by the US and its allies to restrict the country's access to a SWIFT messaging system will be severe. The probability of more severe credit outcomes for foreign holders of debts, Russian debt securities has risen. And the Russian government also may take retaliatory measures in response to sanctions, which could create problems for non-Russian companies that are awaiting payments for routine transactions. And so there are a multitude of risks, Ariane, to Russia, but also to the wider global economy.
Okay, so there are three main channels of credit impact: that commodity price shock, a trade channel, and the financial channel. Which countries are likely to be more or less affected?
In addition to Russia and Ukraine and the banks and companies located there, European countries are the most dependent on Russian energy supply, and those are the countries most at risk. They include Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Hungary, Czech Republic, and of course, Germany. Other countries are also vulnerable to one, trade disruption, to security risks, and third, to cyber attacks. Countries in the Baltics and Central Eastern Europe are most exposed to all three of these risks. And beyond Europe, all countries are vulnerable to a potentially long-lasting oil price shock, as well as food price shocks and heightened uncertainty, as well as deteriorating financial conditions.
And as with the pandemic, we learned that those credits that get hardest hits are the ones that have pre-existing credit fundamentals that are weak. Let's turn to the topic of inflation, Madhvi. Have our views on inflation shifted given the impact on oil and energy prices? And specifically, I want to ask you if we think that these events threaten first the economic recovery and that therefore we would see a slow in the Federal Reserve's rate hike cycle.
Yeah, so the risk to inflation have certainly risen from potentially higher and longer lasting energy and food prices. We don't believe that the Fed will slow its rate hike cycle on account of this shock. However, if anything, even in a scenario of weaker growth, central banks will be more concerned about second round inflationary effects of this potentially large and negative aggregate supply shock, given that it comes at a time when inflation is already quite high. We currently expect the Fed to start a rate normalization process in March, Ariane, and deliver about 4 rate hikes, 25 basis points each this year, followed by another 4 rate hikes next year. We do acknowledge that the path will depend on incoming inflation data as well as labor market data. We also expect the Fed to begin trimming the size of its balance sheet in the second half of this year, which means not just rates at the lower end of the yield curve, the policy rates are likely to rise, but also longer term rates are expected to rise through this year and next. Some of that is already seen in the latest moves in the financial market.
And I assume that then this means that financing conditions will deteriorate and that borrowing costs would also increase. If that's the case, what other macroeconomic implications do you see for emerging markets?
Financial conditions will no doubt tighten, affecting economic growth prospects. At the macro level, commodity importers will feel the most impact, depending on, of course, their import reliance. Commodity exporters overall may benefit from better terms of trade because of higher commodity prices. Still, as I mentioned earlier, we will see a differential impact one level down. So with consumers, for instance, we will see them facing higher costs of energy, food, and other goods that will squeeze their purchasing power. For other goods and firms, will also see cost of production rise.
And Madhvi, last and but not least, how does everything that we have discussed so far impact the central bank's monetary policy decision specifically for emerging markets?
The escalation of the geopolitical tensions between Russia and Ukraine undoubtedly complicate monetary policy decision-making, and especially for emerging market countries. Emerging market monetary policy, we believe, will remain in a tightening mode, even if growth softens, due to the fact that the inflationary risk posed by the commodity price shock are quite significant, in particular for those emerging market countries that have already seen rise in domestic inflation, where central banks have been in a tightening mode for some time. We could see even more tightening.
Thank you, Madhvi. It was a pleasure to have you in the podcast.
Thanks, Ariane. Happy to be here.
I'm joined by my colleague, David Rogovic, from our sovereign team in New York, to discuss our views on global economic scaring. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ariane. Happy to be here.
David, why is economic scarring relevant? Why is recovering economic output lost during the pandemic important for credit quality?
Now, there are a few different ways that scarring can have an impact on sovereign credit quality. The first is through government debt dynamics and the pace of fiscal consolidation. If you think about lower output levels correspond to lower than anticipated income levels for households, for corporates, for an economy overall, and this then has an impact on tax revenue since tax revenue and economic activity are usually closely associated with each other. The degree of scarring can also affect government spending decisions, especially where you have an uneven economic recovery across different sectors. This can really underpin demand for government support or can delay prospects for fiscal consolidation, for removing subsidies, for instance, for cutting back on spending. And then the second way that scarring can affect credit quality is by its impact on aggravating social pressures or by creating new social pressures. What we've seen is the pandemic and the losses in income that came from the pandemic in absolute terms, and also compared with our pre-pandemic expectations for income growth, has reversed or slowed progress in raising per capita income levels and living standards. And this has been a particular problem in developing economies. And so what we see is that scarring potentially aggravates social pressures because it leads to increases in rates of poverty or exacerbates prevailing levels of income inequality.
Forecasting growth has always been difficult, but it was almost impossible in the midst of the pandemic. And we've had some material revisions since. Where have revisions been more meaningful as they pertain to this issue of economic scarring?
Sure. So when we compare our latest forecast against our forecast from the middle of last year, what we see is that we revised up growth prospects for all regions except for Asia Pacific. And this mostly reflects stronger growth in 2021, but we've also seen slightly higher growth prospects in other in regions in 2022 and 2023 as well. There are a few factors that I think explain stronger growth prospects or higher growth forecast now compared to a few months ago. First, the faster rollout of vaccinations in some countries has resulted in easing of containment measures. This is an important factor behind some of our upper revisions to growth in Western Europe and parts of the Eurozone. Even countries where vaccination rates are relatively low and they're still dealing with recurring bouts of new waves of infections, we've also seen the economic impact of containment measures diminish over time. So parts of sub-Saharan Africa, which still have very low vaccination rates, faced third and fourth waves of the pandemic last year. What we've seen is governments responding with more targeted health measures, more targeted containment measures, and the economic impact on growth has been smaller compared to the economic impact of the initial round of measures introduced in the spring of 2020. The last factor I point to is commodity prices, which have been quite buoyant over the past year. And this has supported some upward revisions to growth. I think you can see this most clearly in parts of Latin America, like Chile, Colombia, where we've revised up growth. As I said at the beginning, the one region that's been an exception to this improved growth story is Asia Pacific, where some countries have continued to maintain relatively stringent containment measures in place throughout 2021. This has really dampened growth last year.
Now, how much did our assessment of economic scarring change as a result of these better than expected growth forecasts?
So while stronger growth prospects diminished the degree of scarring, for most sovereigns in most regions, our estimates of scarring haven't really changed that significantly. We continue to see sovereigns in the Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, Caribbean, and sub-Saharan Africa suffering deeper scarring than regions like Western Europe or countries like the US or Canada. It's just now we expect less scarring than we did 6 months ago or a year ago. A few examples of countries where we expect less scarring now than before are some of the Central American sovereigns like Honduras, Guatemala. Remittances have proved stronger and have lasted longer than expected, and that's supported growth this year in 2021 as well. Countries like the Dominican Republic, where tourism is recovering more quickly than even some of its regional peers. But like I said before, for most sovereigns, the changes in our estimates of scarring won't necessarily have immediate credit implications. There are maybe a few examples that are worth highlighting. For example, Costa Rica, which we're seeing faster growth, contribute to a faster pace of revenue growth and fiscal consolidation. And for a country like this, where large fiscal deficits lead to liquidity pressure, the faster pace of fiscal consolidation we're seeing is actually easing financing pressure, and this is a key credit constraint. Another example where we've seen faster growth rates imply even less scarring is in a number of European sovereigns like France, Austria, Netherlands. In these cases, point to even a higher level of economic resilience, which is typically associated with a higher debt carrying capacity.
You mentioned that while economic scarring will be less deep than what we had anticipated, many sovereigns will still experience some degree of scarring. What common characteristics do you see among those countries?
Right. So like I mentioned before, the regions where we expect the deepest scarring are still the Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, Caribbean, and Sub-Saharan Africa. But beyond just the regional comparison, there are actually several characteristics common to those sovereigns where we expect to see deep scarring versus more limited scarring. In general, scarring will be deepest among already weak sovereigns, such as those with low income levels or limited institutional capacity. These are factors often reflected in lower credit ratings, and we do see deeper scarring among non-investment-grade sovereigns versus investment-grade sovereigns. Sovereigns with deeper scarring tend to also have more narrowly focused economies or limited policy buffers in the form of low-income levels, weak institutional capacity, or high debt burdens, which limit their ability to cushion the impact of the pandemic. The reverse is also true. So countries at the higher end of the rating scale with higher income levels and greater institutional capacity to support their economies are likely to emerge from the pandemic with more limited or no scarring. Now, there's one type of economy that's an exception to these generalizations, and that's the tourism-reliant sovereigns, which are a number of them fall in the deepest scarring category, where this is regardless of income levels or quality of institutions. So you have countries like Mauritius, Malta, relatively high-income countries, as well as a number of Caribbean sovereigns like Barbados, Bahamas, where because of their reliance, because of the large exposure to tourism, we expect to see these countries suffer from deeper scarring.
Very interesting, David. Thank you for joining us today. Now, to read more about these research topics and to keep up to speed with our latest views across all emerging markets, you can visit our dedicated Emerging Markets Hub for the latest research, podcasts, and interactive webinars at moodys.com/emerging markets. You can also subscribe to Moody's Talks Emerging Markets Decoded on your favorite podcast channels, including Spotify, Google, and Apple Podcasts. And please do share your reviews and comments for future episodes. Until next time, stay safe and thanks for joining us.